Batu, Baradun, Nikto.
You must remember those words.
Gordon's alive.
You know what the Turing test is?
I know Kung Fu.
Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Stories at a Time Bonus. We're jumping into another extra addition to the main feed, you lucky little people. we are jumping into an extra for something I didn't think I could get more of. we're talking about an alternate version or an earlier version of Hard to Be a God. We talked about the 2016 release on the main feed, the three-hour Russian art piece that produced a visceral reaction from me, to the 1989 joint venture, which is partly French, partly German, with some of the sort of contributors, German language version of Hard to Be a God. This is shorter, just 2 hours, or just over 2 hours. So, we're going to jump in. So I'm going to throw this to you first, Julian. What are your first thoughts on this version of Hard to Be a God?
I am shocked how much I like this.
Me too.
I just think this is like kind of a great movie. It's definitely like a good to excellent movie. It has some signs of being low budget. It doesn't have the grandeur. It's obviously not like directed within an inch of its life, like the acclaimed Russian one. But all of our complaints about that were about plot and, you know, how you're just thrown into this society and this culture. You barely see anything of these, you know, to them, aliens to us from Earth, right? So they're not extraterrestrials. Here, we have all of that. Here, this is like, you know, I said like that's, we could think of that as a Star Trek episode. Here they're leaning into that.
Yeah.
And everything works, man. It just works.
There are two things I want to say. Firstly, I fully agree. I really enjoyed this film. It's 1989. It feels like an 80s sci-fi fantasy film in the best possible way. Like, there are sort of like, there's the feeling of like Dune and like even like Masters of the Universe of like shit going on with this. It's amazing. But also
gore or, you know, like, or like even elements of like life force and, you know.
Yeah, there's some really cool stuff going on. But the other thing is watching this makes me understand the other version way better.
Yes. Yes.
I now understand, you know, not having known the story, not having read, I want to read the novel now. I really want to go and read the book. Like I really do. But one of the things I said was how the 2016 version felt like a fly on the wall documentary. Like there were moments when people are looking into a camera and he's sort of like directing things at the camera and there's all these other bits. Oh, no, it is. That's exactly what it is, because this version completely references that in this version, it's through his eyes, but there are people sat watching 24/7 everything he does. Cataloging it and assessing it, and I just, you know, they're basically sort of, what's the word for anthropologists sat watching this other society. So I was like, oh, that explains a lot. And now I understand about the Grey Army. I understand about sort of like some of the duplicity, the guy with the big sword. I'm like, cool, I get it all now. That film.
Yeah. No, I had the same thought. I was like, you know, this is sort of the actual movie, and that, you know, 2016 one is like the artsy elaboration upon it, which is amazing, but, you know, doesn't have these nuts and bolts. You really get the sense of, you know, the main central conflict, which is to intervene or not, which is, you know, it's the quintessential prime directive thing, yep. right? You know, and you know how it, this is still violent and vicious and upsetting, but it's interesting. Like, it's not as viscerally just gross and upsetting. It has a couple more dead kids. You know, the kids are more important here, but it is more upsetting in the sense of you actually, because you know the plot, you actually know what's at stake. I mean, there's the great line where he's like, you know, do you see this? Where he's talking to the people in the space station / spaceship above. And he's like, you know, do you see, this is the guy who invented their printing press, yeah. right? This is Gutenberg. And he's just been murdered. Right? Yeah. Like, you know, that's very effective. And it really drives home the stakes for the society and how you would be driven to intervene in a way that the other one doesn't.
No, and I love that. That, like, it keeps showing, I mean, the whole film, that the sort of the plot of the movie is, I need to bring it up so I can remember the names of people, but the main sort of thrust is this one guy. You are following this guy who is... and this anthropologist, but he's basically like, he's a scientist, but he's a bit of a badass as well. Like, he's there to be a badass, but like, he has to exist, in this environment. I'm going to find the guy's name, Rumata of Astoria. That's what they sort of calls him. And he's going around and he lives in this place.
That's his local alias. Yeah.
Yeah. That he's taken from a dead man, which you find out later on, which again, I like the fact that he gets pissy with the people because he's like, come on, you've given me, you rushed my identity. No. Like, he gets annoyed with them and stuff. So I like that. But you've got this guy, Rumata, who is this scientist. He's there observing, and he's trying not to intervene. And some of the things he comes across, the guy who invented the printing press, but he was given that information by... One of his colleagues, which I like the fact that, like, there's a colleague who's been drip feeding information into the society. It's like, oh, come on, look, well, think about this, think about that, like, you know, pushing them towards progress. But then he comes across a guy who's invented a telescope, and he's got a tower, and he's like an atheist because they're like, oh, you can't look at the face of God, and he's like, well, what kind of God is there if he doesn't want me looking at his face and all this other stuff, like.
He's a little cheeky, yeah.
Yeah, but it's this idea of progress, and then there's this religious sect run by a character called Reba, who is looking to basically sort of take control. And it's like the Inquisition, or, you know, it's sort of a fundamentalist religion that thinks all education, all learning, all scholarship is bad because you know, books, they're burning books. And all this other stuff, and he's basically sort of, he has got this idiot king, Sauron, who he's trying to usurp, and he's manipulating and stuff. So there's all this sort of like courtly stuff going on, and then Rumata is looking for this one, this scholar, they call him, Burdak.
I think Sauron is actually the like poet guy.
He's the revolutionary, isn't he? There's a king, I think, isn't there?
Yeah.
He's just called King.
Yeah.
And he's wonderful. I love him. But there's all this stuff
Shakespearean in that respect.
There's so much going on with all this. So this conspiracy and this grey army that is growing and is appearing more in this place. And Arcana. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, you know, then you've got on the outside, it keeps cutting to this space station, this spaceship that's observing all this stuff. And then all of a sudden there's this woman who's been watching, I'm going to try and find her name, and she's observing this stuff from the space station, and she's becoming more invested in it as well. Is she O'Connor? The mistress, that's the court mistress, isn't she? Yeah. But she starts getting involved, and people are sort of questioning her and about her emotionality. And then there's a third level they introduce, because it goes back to Earth, and you find that there's an organization, a government that has sent them to observe this far-flung planet that looks like the past, because they're actually looking to see, could this sterile, atheistic future be impacted by integrating or sort of observing this more brutal medieval place. And I just, I've got so much in my head about this.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just like, but I'm sat there like watching it, and it's only in standard definition, so I couldn't find a high definition version of this. The editing is shit in places, like some of the worst sort of like hodgepodge editing at times, and the subtitles were inconsistent. So of the version I had, I was just going, like you said, I watched this, and I was like, I want there to be a special edition of this. I want this scrubbed up. I want a really good subtitle track added to this. Like, this film's really good. There's so much going on.
I agree, and I was amazed by how much I liked it. Especially because I think those ideas that are sort of implicit in the 2016 come through so strongly here.
Mm.
And yeah, it is obviously like so low budget, so you know, not necessarily unambitious, because if anything, it has lots of sets, it has lots of locations, a big cast of extras. But I mean, it's nowhere near the sort of lengthy artistic masterpiece that the 2016, and it's not going for that, but its ideas come through. And, it really is such a fascinating case study in terms of letting those ideas come through and not worrying about, you know, sort of like the CGI or, I'm a sucker for aesthetics, but letting the ideas carry a story forward, really telling a story. This manages to do that in a way that looks cheap at times, but manages to convey it.
Yeah.
And damn if it doesn't convey it, and damn if those ideas are not strong. You get the sense that this is a society that's potentially on that cusp of a renaissance.
Mm.
Some real breakthroughs past this era of dogma and belief that isn't really there. I mean, that's sort of implicit if you read the material, accompanying materials, but it's not really there in the 2016 film. You see much more. I love that you see this like little bunker where they have their sort of like Star Trek installation, outside of time. Oh, that works great. I mean, the helicopter is obviously like, this is what they could rent. It's a little strange that, that's what these aliens
I still love it.
But it still works.
Yeah. Right. I love the fact that they've got this like really technical spaceship, and they're like, but on the planet, we're just going to give you a helicopter to sort of shoot around it. And I'm like, cool, I'm down with that. It looks ace. So.
Well, I like that they're like, yeah, there'll be another dragon report, but you really see this role of religion. I mean, and it's true. I mean, there's no escaping it, including for people who are devout, that, as much as religion has compelled certain people to think kind thoughts of their neighbors, it's certainly been an excuse for some very bad behavior. But also, its view of the world is demonstrably false. Mm. This idea of like, the eye of God, and, what if God doesn't want us to use a telescope? I mean, we've had to fight that every step of the way, and we still are, every step of the way with, cloning and, genetic research. I mean, and even acceptance of the fundamental reality of trans people. I mean, we're still fighting battles about, against people's preconceived ideas of dogma and of what God is that have no bearing on the observable world around us. And I think this dramatizes what a weight that is on human evolution, and not just human evolution, but what a cause for human suffering, even indirectly, even if it's not just the Inquisition, right? It's how many people were raised in squalor with disease, because the progress of getting steam engines and telescopes and microchips was just retarded by dogmatic thinking.
Well, there's a really, I think we're going to end up jumping around quite a bit in this film because there's so much to talk about, but there's a fantastic scene in this where very much towards the end of the film, Ramata has saved Budak, And they're sat, and he's managed to escape this big prison, and which I love the fact they call it the Tower of Joy, which is a fantastic sort of like satire of you know this kind of thing, and they've escaped, and they're sat in this ruin and on this sort of well, it's in this sort of like mountains in mountainous area and these rocks, and Ramata says to him as a scholar, he says, well, you know, if you could say one thing to God, what would you say to him? Like, what would you ask him to do? You can have one wish kind of thing. What would you ask? And he's like, well, what's the point? The guy's like, well, you know, this is the world we live in. It's crap. And this is the world it is. Like, what's that? It can't change. And he's going, and Ramar's going like, no, look, hypothetically, what would you ask? And he's like, I would ask for everyone to be given food and shelter. And he says, okay, well, but then Ramar's like, yeah, but then you're making them lazy. So they won't have earned that. And so, you know, that again, retards progress, and he's trying to sort of like edge him towards this answer, and I just like this sort of, they just sat there, it lasts about 10 minutes, this philosophical discussion about what if you had the opportunity to have God intervene, what would you ask him? And it ends up with like, well, what, you know, would be, why have you done it this way, would be sort of like, you know, they get to the question of, well, you know, you need to ask him why, and what, you know, I just want people to be able to progress is what they sort of get to be free of this dogma. And you can see that Ramat is trying to sort of push him. And I just love the fact that they're happy. This film, as you say, isn't bogged down by needing to jump from set piece to set piece. Like, it will stop and have weird scenes and then have this discussion between these two characters about, you know, Ramat is sort of suggesting like, look, I'm not a god, but if we can, you know, if you could have someone intercede in this way, what would it be?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. What they settle on is basically what he winds up saying is, I would ask God to kill all of us and remake us, right? Yeah. To basically redo the creation of man, which A, suggests he didn't do such a good job the first time, right?
Yeah.
Tailbones included, right? I mean, but basically human nature is fundamentally flawed. And this is sort of the difference between those two societies, right? Third millennium or fourth millennium Earth civilization is a sort of enlightened, even not just Star Trek Federation style no conflict, but even beyond that to a sort of like Vulcan-esque no emotion sort of state of development. You know, which might be a little bit of a cliche, the sort of like beginning of Superman kind of thing of like a society gets so advanced that it becomes kind of sterile and whatnot, which I don't know that there's any evidence for that, but okay. But then, you know, to imply that like God screwed up, what we're really struggling with is, and I think this is true, is, you know, our own natures. And of course, what he can't say is that was created not by God, but by evolution. And, you know, we want things and, you know, it behooved us to be cruel to each other, right? But now we're at a state of development where these petty, you know, adherence to the king, right? Once upon a time, when we were a tribe of 12 people or 100 people, it really mattered that we were unified. Yes. And following that leader really was the difference between surviving and not. And it made a lot of sense to have a totalitarian leader. Now we have, you know, cities. Now, you know, this is his win is what gets a scholar killed. You know, or, you know, that sort of healing sequence where the best scholar is asked to heal him, and you know, you realize, of course, this happened in European history time after time after time, where just being able to, you know, I found myself thinking about how many Shakespeare plays end because of a deus ex machina where somebody just like convinces the king that to really go another direction, right? Mm. And it's like, oh, right, all's well that ends well. Yeah, but nobody should have that kind of power, dude. Right? My survival shouldn't depend on your mood and on somebody coming in and convincing you, you know, not to murder me.
No, I agree. Yeah, and I did like, I love that scene where the guy's like, he checks his knee because he's got a swollen knee and it's awful. And it looks gross and stuff. And he sort of gives him this drink and he says to him, because he makes the doctor, the scholar, drink it himself. And he says, how does it taste? And he's like, it's bitter and horrible, but it'll make you feel better. And so this sort of pampered king drinks it and basically sort of like spits it out. And he's like, it tastes vile and my knee still hurts. And the guy's like, well, you got to drink it for a week.
Yeah.
And it's, but there's this expectation of like instant relief because that's what the king demands. Yeah, and I love the fact that he's like, take him away, and that's it. And you're just like, oh well, you know. I want to get to the sort of one of the things I sort of took from this, which is all sort of around this, is because I love all these ideas. You've got class, you've got this idea of monarchy, and this idea of sort of the religion coming in as a fundamentalist thing that runs everybody's life. And there's so much stuff at the end I want to talk about. But one of the things that I found I was thinking about is this is based on a novel that was written by a couple of guys, I think the brothers or whatever, but written, let's try to find. There you go, yeah. What's on my time? I've got Boris Strugatsky and Arkady.
Yeah.
Strugatsky, yeah, these two brothers, right? I really want to read this. They were living during the USSR, the Russian communist state. And one of the things that sort of, as I was thinking that and watching this, that did not come to me whilst watching the 2016 version, but it feels very much of a piece in this, is communist Russia, especially like Lenin and Stalin's Russia, was very much about, there was no religion, or you know, they sort of suppressed the stress of religion. It was about for the good of the people. It was all about trying to be progressive in some ways, but they were reliant on, but the problem was they were still reliant on this farming underclass that, you know, that had to produce all the food and all this other stuff. And I couldn't sort of get past this idea of this film and this story being this idea, especially when it goes back to this station and back on Earth and this station watching, is this society that believes itself to be better, more progressive, better for the people, for the, you know, for the will of the people, the good of the people, having removed itself from religion and all this other stuff, having to watch what it considered to be either these barbaric religious states, which could be Europe and the rest of the world, but could just as easily be these satellite countries that it had around this the USSR, that were, you know, these small, poor farming countries, these, you know, communities. And because this whole story, which I find fascinating, is the crux is, do we intervene and help them? But also in parallel to that, how do they possibly corrupt us?
Mm-hmm.
And I could feel, listen, I was thinking, this is an allegory for how that central Russian ideal, that communist ideal, was at odds with this, these former sort of Orthodox Catholics, sort of, you know, Russian Russian Orthodox religion and
peasants
and all this sort of, like, you know, that wouldn't have been educated, but they were trying to be taught this new ideology and all this other stuff. And I was thinking, okay, this to me is the story of mid 20th century Russia trying to sort of combat itself, dealing with these sort of like medieval peasants that lived on the outskirts of the Russian state. I don't know. It just felt, you know, that's where I was getting to with this original story. And this really, really came through in this film for me.
Yeah, I mean, and that is, you know, for Russian scholars, you know, I think one of the defining issues of the 20th century, you know, was this tension. And, you know, the higher ups wanting to, you know, pull Russia into the 20th century, you know, kicking and screaming. And, you know, but then again, those higher ups were corrupt. Those higher ups were, you know, I mean, was it, you know, like the death of Stalin captures that, you know, very,
yes,
very accurately, actually,
yeah,
you know, in terms of how how stupid it all was, and how, you know, how stupid, you know, what a cult of just personality, you know, worshiping.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's just, you know, where your power at the court was based on, you know, like whether you danced appropriately for Stalin, you know, like really stupid shit. So, like, that's not in this, right? Because the, no, like, the Earth civilization is just the enlightened one here.
But is it? But this is the thing. This is the point, yeah. I think that this is trying to make is it enlightened? Because I think one of the points of this story is almost like, and I'm going to make a reference to another film that we've watched. And it's going to be an odd one. You're not going to see this coming. But one of the things that I get with this film is Ramata in particular, and also the woman that he sort of communicates with that's on the spaceship. There's this sort of, there's this balance between being distance and being, you know, have being not cold, but having, you know, logic and, as you say, that Vulcan approach almost. And then what they keep talking about it. But when he's, I forget what he's doing, whether she starts crying. She's when he's sort of at one point, like, you know, communicating with the woman that's in his room, and she sort of,
yeah, this is a really beautiful scene.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful. It's really well done. And it's sort of, there's all this stuff that, like, and it's this realization of, like, well, because he says, like, how can I be this cold and detached if I'm in here? Because I've had to live with these people. I've made friends, and you're asking me to sort of let them die. I can't do that. And it felt to me like there's this, one of the points of the story is, yes, we've got to progress. Yes, we've got to get better. And yes, you know, we've got to sort of evolve and do this, but we can't lose our humanity in doing so. And all I could think of was like, this feels a little bit like Demolition Man.
Well, it makes me think that's the central of an earlier sci-fi film, because it's the central thing of Metropolis, right? Mm. Which is the, you know, the like upper echelon, which is emotionless and mechanical and represents that like industrial at that time, the sort of like industrial Henry Ford kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then the lower classes who are all heart and golly gee, all emotional, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is a somewhat different dynamic. But you're right. I mean, the Demolition Man has that same sort of heart and head kind of thing. I mean, that scene, though, is so beautiful. It's what he's saying is, like, he's trying to tell her, I come from a more enlightened place. And he says, like, you know, there's no need for suffering. There's no...
No hunger. Yeah.
Yeah, we've overcome hunger. And, you know, and he says, like, and war, we don't kill each other anymore. He says, yeah, we used to, but we, you know, that's, we would never do that now. She says, so there's no crying anymore. He says, no, there's no crying. And you sort of think that that's a metaphor for sadness, right?
Mm.
But then you sort of realize, oh, no, they really don't have that emotion anymore. And then you cut to the woman on the spaceship with tears streaming down her face as she's hearing this. And obviously identifying with what he's going through and having seen so much preventable suffering. And then everybody on the spaceship is now reacting to her crying and how she's been sort of contaminated by this. That juxtaposition of the dialogue.
It's wonderful.
Wrong. It's just, yeah.
That's one of the downfalls. I do like their reaction. Everyone on the spaceship's like, she must be tired. They're all like, go have a rake. Like, they literally just go, like, you know, there's a bit of mansplaining go on. Basically, four guys walk over and they're just like, bless her, she's tired. Which is kind of funny. But I love that scene. I absolutely love that scene. But one of the things I do think you say about the aesthetics, weirdly, I find the aesthetics of this film really appealing. I think the costuming is good. I think some of it's really well thought through. It has a really cool sort of, like, it's alien fantasy, but maintains that medieval feel. Like, you know, it hasn't gone, like, the 2016 version is full medieval Europe. You know, it's gone for that sort of ideal. This is still maintaining that sort of, like, fantasy medieval approach. That, like, you know, this could be Dune or Flash Gordon, or, you know, it's got that sort of bit of that aesthetic going on, which I absolutely adore. I think it looks great. And so it looks good, and I think some of the sets are good, and there's just some really interesting stuff going on. And unfortunately, like I said, there are scenes that are so badly edited, like, continuity errors in some of the edits where like there's someone running to jump off something and then the next thing they're like there's somebody else there with them and you're like, where do they come from? Like that's like some really odd choices. Or just some bad things where you can see like the budget has really let this down. But one of the things I was kind of surprised by, going back to this thing of the aesthetic and stuff, that it feels, as I said, I've used those references of like Flash Gordon and Dune. I'd even say sort of like the canon version of Masters of the Universe, sort of like, you know, that sort of like big hair and all stuff going on. And then all of a sudden, like at one point, this, because it starts as like any sort of, I wouldn't say family friendly, but like it starts in a certain way. And then all of a sudden it has a lynching. And then all of a sudden this film sort of like ups its game. And you said about the gore, and it's not gory in the same way. It's not visceral, but like at one point, I think it is that one of the medics or one of the scholars is hung, and then it sort of pans out, and there's just these bodies hanging off the side of this castle. And then
is still the same story, right?
And as you said, like there's a scene where I think it's O'Connor, this woman, and she acts as sort of like she's almost like a. Not so much a spy, but she's the mistress of Reba, the priest, the head of the thing, but then she sort of offers herself to.
She's like a concubine who tries to play both sides and gets caught.
Yeah, and then there's a bit where she goes. She's helping sort of to look for this Budak, scholar, but then Reba confronts her in the Tower of Joy, the prison. And then he shows her
where
around.
Where we see a screaming kid.
And that's what I'm saying.
On a sort of rack.
Yeah, and then he opens a door and there are children being tortured. And she screams and he sort of laughs at her. And I'm like, oh my God, this film keeps sort of like, I keep forgetting what this story is. And then it reminds you in like, oh yeah, no, this is brutal. Like this is... And it keeps doing it in a really good way. Like it's never showy. It's never like... you know, blood spraying everywhere. There's a couple of moments when they do that, but you know,
yeah, it doesn't have that same sense of dirtiness and like you know, just visceral sort of stuff that the 2016 one does. But you know, it does. You know, and I think you need a bigger budget to do that, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this accomplishes, you know, much of the same. You know, it does something different. But I think it does it in a very different way.
Yeah. But what I like that this does, and this is the thing, because you say about the aesthetic, but one of the things I like this does, because the other one presented this horrible, dirty, they've got the bodies being covered in fish oil because it makes the birds can eat them and all this other stuff. Like, you know, they're hanging everywhere. Like, it's a sickening world, but because it's everywhere. But one of the things that's most interesting about this is, and this goes, I think, back to this sort of analogy of it being like this political view, is when you go to the king's court, everything's clean for this medieval place, and it's, you know, everyone's drinking from big tankards, and they're all sort of, there's women, and everyone's in fancy clothes, and they have this thing where they get, you know, the honor of putting on the king's right shoe or left shoe is a real honor and stuff, and so
that's remarkable. Great. Yeah,
I love that as well. But everything there is this pristine kind of world, and even when you see the peasants are still sort of like the peasantry, and they're farming and they're devout to this religion thing. But then even more behind that, you have this Tower of Joy, which is this horrible, torturous prison, which is part of the control mechanism that's keeping the society in thing, and they've given it this name, and that's where all the bodies are being hung and this stuff. And it's this sort of like, that's where the terror is contained. That's where the violence is all contained in this sort of this. And I like that like everything else is okay. We sort of don't look that way. We acknowledge it's there, but we don't really talk about it. But that's where the Tower of Joy is. And it's sort of, that's where the kids are tortured and everything else.
I mean, you do see sort of the sort of pressing on the nails to kill people, you know, later on. It's a sort of like guillotine-esque, sort of like slightly more humane, actually. Like, they don't say that, but, you know, these people are dying very quickly compared to the Tower of Joy. So, I mean, there is a little bit once the grays get kind of out of control.
After,
But
yeah.
yeah, and I don't know. I'm of two minds about what you're saying, because on the one hand, I like the 2016 depiction of just, filth and the brutishness of the society overall. The cavalier way of that people blend with animals, that is not in this and that is very medieval. There are elements of that that I like, but there are elements that just sort of, if not feel overdone, that sort of blend everything together. And so it's hard to tell that the grays in this religious movement are so different, right? You're made to understand that they're an escalation, but they're an escalation over and above an already unacceptable, out of control level of violence and gore. And so maybe somewhere in the middle is where I would
Yeah. If this
tend to
had more
fall.
budget, if this version had a bigger budget, I think they would probably be closer to that ideal. Because it feels limited, like it or that Tower of Joy. I don't think it's just a is just a is a story thing. I think it's a budget restriction
Oh,
as
sure.
well. But
And I mean, the way they shoot even like that kid, right? I mean, they
yes,
shoot people in a way that it's clearly the budget, right? They're not
yeah,
showing the wounds.
no, it's implied in a lot of cases. But but yeah, but it works. I think that's the thing. Like, it really works for me. Because one of the things I like about this is the character of Ramata is, like you say, he has it within his home, but which was the home of somebody else that was killed, which was one of the scientists which tried his luck and was actually outed. He wasn't, but he was out as a conspirator against the king. And I love all that as well. When he's given a sword and he's like, "Oh, this will help you out," and they try to escape, and then Reba pulls out this sword and is like, "Oh, look. He was trying to kill the king, and he's executed and stuff." So that sort of triggers the plot. But when he gets the house, I love the fact they've got, you said, that this sort of like Star Trek room where he has to sort of like be checked in with the station, and they check out his eyes and his skin, and he has to take certain tablets to be able to survive on the planet to combat disease and all this other stuff. And there's all these little bits that I'm like, oh, that's really that. I like all that. And then they said there's another one where, like, the head of their whatever, their sort of their landing party, has got his own one in the mountains where the helicopter's kept, and they're all in communication with this space station. All that is really good as well. I'm liking all that because I like the fact that, like, this sort of, you see the, and again, I'm doing this through dodgy subtitles in the case, where I'm getting everything, but it's sort of a little bit disjointed. But Romance is like real, sort of like he's getting frustrated with the people up in the space station, and they're getting confused by his frustration because they're not there. And you see this constant escalation, this sort of devolution, because he's then like he's made friends. He's got like a this lad who like works for him in the house. He's now got this sort of maid that he sort of is who he shares this information with. And at one point, he attempts to rape her, but then he stops because he's like, no. Like, I'm not like you. He's been pushed to the edge, and he almost attacks her and stuff. And it's sort of that was kind of powerful to me, where he's sort of like, sort of I forget what happens before. It was something has happened that triggers him. I think it's actually the death of his friends and stuff. And he sees some stuff, and he's like, right, fine, I'm just as bad as you. And he sort of rips her clothes off, and she's like about to sort of give in because she knows that's her role. And then he sort of stops himself and he's like, yeah, I'm not that. I'm not that. And he sort of covers her up and leaves her. And I love how this character is sort of like really struggling with all this and keeps trying to throw things. Like, he helps Sauron to help the revolution when he's like, you can't attack these people head on. You're gonna have to ambush them. You're gonna have to do this and that. And he keeps trying to give them this information. And he's just a fascinating character throughout. And I that there is this thing of anthropology. They all say, like, you impact what it is you observe, but what you observe clearly impacts you as well. And it just this thing keeps coming through, and it's just wonderfully presented.
Well, that anthropology thing is a fascinating point. I mean, first of all, there's no unbiased observation, right? Mm. But the thing that I kept thinking of is colonialism. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you, you know, if you read like Shooting an Elephant, you know, and experiences of colonialism, going back to Montaigne thinking about, you know, on cannibals and stuff. There is this idea that, like, this was presented as this, in that case, not, obviously, there was not a non-interference policy, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but it was presented as a civilizing effort, right?
Yes.
And a Christian civilizing effort, you know, saving the souls of, you know, these people.
Bringing civilization to the savages.
Right. And literally saving their souls, right? I mean, it doesn't matter how many we kill, they're going to go to heaven. You know, more of them are going to go to heaven because we were there, right?
Yes.
Like, we are benefiting them. And if you believe that, that's absolutely true. There's no way around that. But, you know, so this was presented as this very civilized and civilizing effort. But there was this way in which, you know, both people, you know, the colonizer and the colonized wind up flipping roles in these weird ways, mm. right? In which, like, the person doing the civilizing effort winds up feeling less than, right?
Yeah.
Because what they've had to do has dehumanized them. And they would write about it. They would write about, you know, like, I have shot people today, right? Like, I am less than. I am going to go home a broken man. You know, what I have seen here and what has been done in the name of civilization has destroyed me and fundamentally altered my ability to have faith in my civilization mm-hmm. and in God, right? Like, I came here to sell God and Europe, and I came back having lost faith in those things exactly because of what we have done. So I think these sort of spaces of radical encounters of disparities of culture or technological level become these kinds of spaces where, you know, things start inverting and we, you know, the colonizer has to confront themselves in this weird way.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. And I totally see that in this film of, you know, the colonizer. Because then I also think of other examples of this. Like, I'm thinking Dances with Wolves, you know, mm. where this idea of, where these things have happened, and these have happened, like you say, in real life, where you say these people, you know, where we stormed our way across, you know, Africa, Asia, Middle East, and brought civilization at the end of a gun and a bayonet, really. It was, this feels, the one thing I said that's interesting about this is, although a lot of those were bringing the Bible and civilization, as I say, at the point of a bayonet. This is almost like trying to be one of the key things that Romato is. He never kills for the vast majority of the film. Like, they even make a point of it at one point where he's like, "Oh, you disarmed these people, but you never killed them."
Yeah, they tell him you can't kill.
Yeah, well, right. even some people in the king's court highlights it. I think Reba points out at one point, "Well, you disarmed these people, but you never killed anyone. You never killed any of my men." But the thing is, like, at the end, when the Grey Army takes over and stuff, and he goes to save his friends, and at the time, like, that changes. Like, all of a sudden, he's like, "No, mm-hmm. I'm all in. Like, you've got to intercede. Like, you've got to do the right thing, for these people." And so you're right. It's almost like he feels he has to meet this place on its own terms in order to better it. Like, you can't be a passive observer in this world. Like, if you want to make change, you've got to be in the mud, basically. You've got to be in the thick of it to make that change. And I think that's why I like the finale. I think the ending of this film is fascinating, because he's given up in this sense. He's distanced himself from his from Earth. Like, he is now, he's almost accepting his role as Ramata. He flies a helicopter into battle, which is ace. I love that. Love that.
Scott's like, any movie that involves like a whether it's Rambo or like, you know, Airwolf or
Airwolf. Airwolf was what came to my mind. I was thinking that music. I'm all in on this. Was ace. I thought it was brilliant. I thought it's this thing of like, he's not just gone like, oh, fuck it, I'm going in with my swords. He's going, no, I'm going in with this helicopter. And so I really like that. But what I find more fascinating is that when they get into the castle, like he takes off that hair as well. Like he has this big wig that he wears throughout. And it's sort of like, I'm done with this charade. Like I'm done with all that.
I love that too. Yeah.
Yeah. But what's interesting, he beats Reba. Like he kills Reba. Everyone all of a sudden is like, oh my God, Reba's no longer. They stop worshipping Reba. And all of a sudden they all bow down to Ramata.
But even before that, like this is such an amazing, you know, like the Star Trek moment, right? Where it's like, because like they all those Star Trek episodes that are basically like these people with these spaceships would be interpreted as gods, right? Mm. And like Apollo was just some, you know, extraterrestrial, right?
I'm literally reading Chariots of the Gods at the moment. It's that kind of thing, yeah.
Exactly, and while I don't know that I literally believe that, I mean, we have seen cargo cults. Mm-hmm. We know, like, it is really weird, some of the stuff that we have done as people on Earth, right? As if there are gods coming down from heaven, right?
Yeah.
It is very cargo cult kind of behavior. Okay, with that aside, like, the way they're like, oh, that spaceship, which I love that design of it, even though, I mean, the blue screen stuff is very 1980s. But I love that, you know, that design of that spaceship. And they're like, oh, it's the Eye of God.
Yes,
right? Like,
that's what I was going to say.
Proves our religion, right? Which is so totally like, you read the Bible and you're like, oh, a star descended to Earth and guided them. Right. Oh, yeah. A star descended to Earth. Oh, really? You know, you follow the star around on Earth.
There was several, because I do want to, and I love that moment, because I was questioning, like, is it intentional? They lowered themselves to try and sort of like, right, we can't have them believing there's a flaming helicopter flying around. So we need to enforce the supernatural by doing something. But one of the things that's interesting, you say about the Son of God, there is a reference twice in this film to a man that was born of a star. And they keep making references to sort of like pseudo-Christian stories and stuff throughout this film. So there is the possibility of the Grey and that being based on these sort of Christian ideals that have sort of like not the same as ours, but run sort of parallel. And I love that they're not going to be like, oh, it's the Son of God, but there is a man that was born of a star. So when that ship comes down at the end, they then see that Ramata is the son that was born of the star. He is the foretold one. And that's when I was like, oh my God, this is like so, yeah, it's brilliantly well done.
And it's very understated. I mean, I love talking about this with you. Like, I mean, but even those like sculptures of like the pagan non-Christians, like with the three heads kind of sticking out of their head, like it's so like primitive and pagan and channels this kind of like energy that's so amazing. So well done. But so at that end, the spaceship is sort of coming down and they're interpreting it based on their religion and they're claiming him. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So it's this sort of Star Trek moment. And then I interrupted you.
Oh, no. Yeah. Then, like you say, they all bow to him, don't they? But then he is paralyzed. And then they have this sort of, that's when they finally intercede. Like there literally is Chariots of the God where these beings from outer space come down and clean up the bloody mess, basically.
Well, before they intercede...
Oh, Sauron.
Sauron picks up a Star Trek phaser.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And goes
just
mental.
Blasting away. And it's like, I'm like, oh my God, I'm watching like a native in a Star Trek episode pick up a phaser and go full Grand Theft Auto. Right. Yeah. Like he's just like blasting statues and blasting people, and people are burning and they're on fire.
He's amazing because he's obviously he's a like a not a poet, what do they call him, a bard. Mm. Like he's been going, he's a singer. Yeah. Like he thinks music is the way to go and stuff. And he, but he's been, but he's, and he's trying to.
You know, I've met an AK-47. Let me tell you, as an American, no poet survives that.
You have a machine gun. I have a bandolier. But it's sort of, he leads this revolution, and he has all this other bits and pieces. But then at the end, he's been crucified upside down, mm. and he's saved. So he is proper pissed off by the end of this, and he has seen because it's Ramata has that phaser. So when he gets it, like you say, it's the fact that it starts, his performance is it took me a minute. I actually went back to watch this. When he starts firing, it's in anger. Like he grabs that phaser and he's just like, killing all these people. And then it turns into like madness. And he's like cackling, his tongue's out. And it's like a power thing. And he's just shooting everybody. And he doesn't stop until he's confronted by the woman that's been watching all this. And he has it pointed at her, and she's all in white. And again, they've got like a nose thing on because it's very much like Dune. They have to be sort of, the atmosphere's not quite right. Yeah. And she just sort of takes it from him. And he's sort of just, he's been an atheist. Like you've seen him. He's been sort of like, I'm not really sure there's this God thing is right. There's probably more to go to it. And all of a sudden he's confronted by this being, and it's just this really, you know, you can see him being sort of like, I don't know how to process this at all. And he's sort of stunned into silence, and he just hands over the gun. And it's and then she sort of gasses him and makes him go to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. The gas is a little weird. I love that moment where he just sort of melts in the presence of, you know, and I think that's very realistic. You know, I mean, he's not at his core a fighter. Right.
No.
And in the presence of this clearly alien/God, right? I mean, it's sort of the point of, you know, in real life, if you met Superman, you'd just be like,
I just love this whole ending. I think it is so. And then they just take Ramata away. Like there's no.
Yeah.
He's put on a gurney. He's been paralyzed. He gets put on a gurney and taken away. And it's sort of,
and then you're left to think, what does this mean for the civilization, right? I mean, they're going to have tell myths about this, right? This is going to be the start of a cargo cult.
Exactly. Well, this is what I find fascinating. Is like they gas them all to put them all to sleep so they can do what they're going to do. But there's nothing then. There's no dialogue about we've wiped their memories. There's nothing about sort of this or that. Like they're just left with this experience that they've pretty much reinforced of like, there was this being, he had these powerful weapons, and then he was returned to the stars.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's it. I will say there's one thing in this end, there's one thing that took me out of this finale that I was a bit, it was a bit weird. It made me chuckle. There's almost like a Monty Python level joke. I think it's unintentional. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
So they've got this like press thing that's like you said, this sort of like Iron Maiden thing that kills the people. And there's one guy that's about to be killed.
They lean somebody back on this and then it comes down and puts these spikes through. And you see lots of, and that's what I was saying is like they're guillotined because it kills them quickly. And then they just slide down. It's kind of cool. They slide down the bamboo chute and they're just with the other bodies and stuff. So there's a guy on there waiting to be killed.
And then, like you say, it sort of stops because Ramata's appeared and the Eye of God's coming down and everyone's frozen. And he says, to be saved by the gods. And then everyone kneels and the guy lets go with the thing. He lets go with the handle and the guy's killed.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's like Monty Python level, like dark humor. Like I was.
It is proper Python.
But it's
Way.
Yeah.
At the time, I felt like watching it the first time, you know, through, I was like, even at this moment, he is not spared, right? Like, even at this moment, this is still a vicious, evil sort of, you know, but it is that sort of like Indiana Jones gag too, right?
Yes.
Like, and so in retrospect, as I was preparing for the podcast, I recall that moment and had a chuckle and was like, oh, wait a minute. That's kind of funny. That does not work the way they think it does.
No, that's not. It doesn't work the way they intended. Like that was clearly supposed to be a tragic moment when I'm going like, oh no, that's that's Life of Brian, like kind of funny. But yeah, no,
we're all spared. I'm not.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's like you're bringing out your plague victim, isn't it? Sort of like, I'm not dead. Yes, you are. Sort of. But when I left this film, the credits come up, and it does end. Like, that's it. That's the end. Like, the credits just start. And I was sort of sat there for a couple of minutes, a little bit stunned, in the sense of, I was like, I've watched this film for 2 hours. I've been wholly invested in this film. It's you know, this is a rather poorly edited, lowish budget European film made in the late 80s by West Germany and France, based on a Russian novel with some dodgy subtitles in parts. I have been really impacted by this film, like surprisingly so. I went in with trepidation. I went in thinking, what the hell am I going to watch if I've just watched a 3-hour version of this?
This is a lower budget version from many years earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is a fantastic film. It really is. And we've had foreign films before, and we will have many more in the future. But many of them have been well known. You know, they're available on Blu-ray, or they've had a special edition, or they're lauded as, you know, the better original or whatever. This is never mentioned. I'd never heard of this until you brought this up. And I just think that's a real shame.
No, I agree. And I had the same response. And I secretly want to say that my secret thought is that the thing is, we have to not do artsy fartsy foreign films, right? Godzilla's fine, goes over fine with you, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's the artsy fartsy stuff, right? And the key thing is, this feels like a 1980s American movie, right? With like the blue screen, like, and it's about something. Like, it's trying to do cool stuff, but it's low budget, you know, like it's not artsy fartsy, and it's got a low budget. I mean, I think that's the key thing. I mean, it's really impressed with the fact that it's got a helicopter and it's gonna work that in, right? Like, you know, it is charming. We just have to get more of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, no, the thing is, like, you know, there have been good films, but you know, Eyes Wide Shut and
Eyes Wide Shut. Eyes Wide Shut is the
Tom
Kubrick,
Cruise one.
Open Your Eyes.
Open Your Eyes and Eyes Without Face. Those films are wonderful, and I love those.
Oh yeah. I'm teasing you a little, but
but this does. What I find interesting is though that the people that wrote this, I'm not sure if it is. Are these the same people that wrote Roadside Picnic, which became Stalker, and obviously there's
no. That's Stanislaw Lem.
Oh, that was Lem that wrote that. Okay.
Yeah.
Because
Strugatsky.
Strugatsky, the two Strugatsky brothers. But like this is also showing to highlighting to me, a wealth of like science fiction literature that's out there as well. That like, you know, yeah. I've just not been known about it. And this is where I'm thinking, like, you know, yeah, I really want to read. Stalker's going to have to be in one of our, you know, we're talking about doing a post-apocalyptic series, you know, very soon. And Stalker is very much a post-apocalyptic thing, so we can fit those things in. But like, there's this sort of like these non-English speaking, you know, these non-English novels and films. I'm like, oh yeah, like there's, you know, we're not limited to this stuff. And there's obviously translations, but like, yeah, it just doesn't get talked about as much. And I just feel like I'm being opened up to it. Oh, no. Roadside Picnic was by the two brothers.
No, was it?
Yeah, it is by these two brothers. That became Stalker. I know. So there's Stanislaw Lem wrote Solaris. Yeah.
Yeah. Good call. Thanks for correcting that. I don't know. I mean, I always feel like, and this is part of why I got a French degree, I explored European graphic novels and stuff. And, you know, I mean, in 1980s and 1990s, there was no manga or European work and comics published in America that I didn't buy. Because I was just so hungry to put these cultures, these different traditions in dialogue with each other and stop having just one national conversation to really talk about the art form. And in this case, we're talking about a genre. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when you talk about like great literature, obviously, you know, we're still integrating, you know, we're still integrating Asia into the Western pantheon, right? But like, you know, the Russian novel, you know, it's been totally integrated for, you know, 100 years. I mean, you know, there has been, you know, a sort of integration across Europe. And it's still really like the Chinese canon that we're trying to figure out, right? How to understand in the West. Less so Japan. I mean, you know, that's been more open. But there is, in science fiction, we're still at this earlier point, right? Where, you know, we're aware of these novels, but some of them don't even have English translations. That's like, what?
Yeah.
It's flabbergasting.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, I'm looking at, I've just put in one of the brothers just to sort of, it's quite hard to Google both, but Hard to Be a God, written obviously by both of them, released in 1964. Roadside Picnic was 1972. There's one called The Doomed City, 1972. Monday Begins on a Saturday, Snail on the Slope. All of these have been translated, and they are now part of the Science Fiction Masterworks series, which is quite extensive. I mean, they've done that, and that's actually quite good. I've got a couple of books through that series, so it's worth looking at. But there's one here that sounds interesting, and it'd be something I might track down because it'd be quite fascinating. It's called Prisoners of Power, Best of Soviet Science Fiction, as an anthology. And I think that'd be quite interesting, for sort of delve into that idea of science fiction coming from, you know, the sort of Soviet era Russia. So, yeah.
Interesting.
So anyway, I do want to say, obviously, soon we're going to be doing the end of season review. We're going to be given our scores for all the films we've done on the main feed. We'll be updating to the sort of the rest. Something I want to clarify right now. This version of Hard to Be a God definitely getting a higher score than the main feed version of Hard to Be a God.
Isn't that fascinating? I mean, and I think that, you know, we've done a bunch of these sort of side things, you know, for the Patreon, and in most cases they're, you know, they've been more disappointing. I mean, think about the difference between like Battle Royale, which to me is a masterpiece, and Battle Royale 2, which we excoriated and spent half that episode laughing at. And here, I tend to agree with you. I mean, and I'm sort of two minds because I love the aesthetic of the 2016. And I'm so impressed by it as a project. But if I had to show somebody something, I would show them this. And, you know, one of the things that made me think about is, we were talking before the show about Villeneuve and Dune. Like, don't you want like a Villeneuve redo of this?
100%.
Didn't you think that? Like, yeah. Oh my God, can we get that kind of, like, this is such an amazing story. There's so much stuff going on and it's so challenging. And you could do it with a little bit more money, a little bit, you know, smoother special effects and stuff. And, you know, I mean, with somebody who can bring those kinds of chops to it, you know, and not cut corners and really stick to their guns about what it's really about, this could be just a masterpiece, a devastating sci-fi.
Yeah, and you know, this is that thing of like having we've spoken. You know, we obviously covered the first part of June. We've talked about Blade Runner 2049, and we both watched. Like Villeneuve is the right person. You know, he has the sensibilities. I think he would have the aesthetic for this. Yeah, no, that would be phenomenal. And I think actually this is one of those things that you could. You know, we've gone through this idea of this being an original. Originally about I saw it as Russia, you know, the Soviet Union sort of at odds with itself about progress versus sort of like the peasantry and their sort of reliance on it. You could easily take this and then start covering off a more modern version. You said about sort of modern colonialism or even just sort of like the reliance on religion and its sort of retardation of progress and stuff like. Yeah, you can adapt this and really sort of hits at home with some modern analogies and
it would probably be a bridge too far to have the bald guy who's in charge of the Greys, instead of being bald, have a big orange wig.
Yes.
Maybe yeah. A little too on the nose.
Yeah. There's other ways, you know, I think, yeah, but close. I think you could have they all wear red, you know. Make Akanar great again, kind of thing.
Oh yeah, you know, and we're gonna get rid of those spies. I love that, you know, the talk. I love the talk of spies, right? The spies,
the conspiracy.
The conspiracies and those spies. You never see any actual spies, right? This is just used for internal purposes, right?
Yeah, and the king obsessed with them, terrified of them, and he says it's these conspiracies in my court, and like everyone else is going like, what? Like there is none.
What? You're right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when we complete Arcanar exit, we'll, you know, finally be free of those French. I mean, spies. You know,
exit. I don't know. Say yeah, but yeah, that's it. There's so much there. This is. I mean, it's ripe. For a remake, this is ripe for a Western version. Like it's
talk about like issues that are so dear to my heart. Like, you know, and it's not just religion, right? I mean, it's about thinking about humanity in the long run, right? Having a historical concept, a historical concept of humanity. Understanding if you want to talk about civilization, right? Let's not talk about the stupid carrying it on your back, you know, to the colonies. Let's not talk about make America great again or make Britain British or whatever the hell nonsense. Let's really talk about civilization and let's talk about how we are always in danger of being of losing it, of being pulled back to, you know, a state of, you know, of suffering the likes of which you and I have never experienced in our lifetimes. But that was the norm for all of human history. And I take what we have accomplished very seriously. I take preserving it very seriously. And to me, those elements, whether they're religious or just petty, stupid, we were talking about just secular bureaucratic nonsense before the podcast too. To me, those are also enemies of, you know, progressing as a species and securing this kind of, you know, real civilization, not, you know, a sort of dumb idea of religious cultural civilization, but, you know, technological advancement, lowering of human suffering, having enough food, not dying in stupid wars all the time, all around the planet, you know. I mean, these are great things that we have accomplished. And there are forces, whether they're capitalist or bureaucratic or communist or whatever, or religious or what have you, that would like to drag us back there or at least do not care. Yeah. And to me, this is, nothing could be more vital than this message.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree. I think I've been wonderfully surprised by this film. And you know, like I said, it's been a fantastic chance to discuss this. You know, this has been just a fascinating discussion, really. I'm so glad I've got to see it. Any final thoughts on Hard to Be a God 89?
I think I just gave it. I'm just delighted that we both like it so much.
Mm.
And what a sort of gem it turned out to be.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I went in with trepidation, serious trepidation, thinking, right, what am I going to see? Especially because it was only in standard definition. So I was like, okay, it's going to be a bit ropey. But I was so, as I said, I was just so brought into this film. And it just sort of, there was so much there. It's well layered, it's well done, it's well written. It's, you know, the performances and everything that work. It's a good film for the budget it's on. I'm just saddened that this seems to have been a little bit lost to history, really. I found it on Amazon, rented it for £2.49. It's there, but this definitely feels like it should be. You know, it needs to be scrubbed up. Give me a high definition version with a decent subtitle track and stuff, and I'll be much happier. I'd buy it. I'd definitely go back and watch this again. I won't watch the other one.
I want to see the cut that combines them.
Yeah. That could be quite interesting.
Yeah, I'd like to make that cut, you know.
That, oh, those fan edits, like a Snyder cut, four and a half hours long.
Yeah, I want the $100 million budget to produce that one.
Yes. Yeah, I'll have to set the money. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a bit of a, we've got, you know, we've run a little long on this, but I think it's well deserved. Seriously, go check this film out. Of all the films we've talked about on this bonus series, go check this out. I'm going to be promoting the hell out of this. I think this is a fascinating film. But anyway, now, I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for the support. We really appreciate it. And we will be back with more Stories of Time and Space bonus soon enough. So for now, thank you very much, and we'll talk again soon.